This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week's episode, Teams, Trios and Fellowships, The Importance of Friendships in Speculative Fiction.
So we're very happy to welcome onto the show today Ben Barman-Gann, who is the author of Witchman Road. Nice to have you on the show, Ben.
Nice to be here.
Hi, Ben. Now, your book, Witchman Road, is very much about friendship. It's kind of a superhero story, but what I loved about it was how Peter and Joshua interacted. That was really the golden thread running throughout the story, because Peter humanises Joshua, while Joshua, who is a fair bit older, teaches Peter how to adapt to what's happened to him. Sorry, I'm waffling. Go and read the book if you're listening to this. It's great. Anyway, you've tackled friendship head on here. So, Ben, what made you zero in on that as a theme?
See in these people, in these fictional characters that I watch. And I felt like there was this weird resistance to two people in a platonic ideal who aren't blood relatives saying that they love each other, which I think is insane.
I agree.
Like, Spock loves you guys. It's fine. actually, that one, like, I'm a little suspicious of. Like, you know, because Bones is already the quirky best friend in the romantic comedy that is Star Trek. So yeah. Spock is actually the... Never mind.
Don't keep going.
I have a lot of thoughts on that. And like you know, you jump into Harry Potter and friends are the best. Like, friends are always the best part to me, and it's always this kind of the sweetest and this thing that, like, you know, even you go into Lord of the Rings. It just, in all of the respects, I think two people trying to be friends is, I think, one of the most beautiful stories, but it's one that we always take for granted or push aside or are weirdly resistant of letting male characters be, like, sappy and melodramatic, which I'll pretend I did on purpose, and it's not just because I'm a sappy and melodramatic guy.
sappy melodramatic guys. It's okay.
Yeah. No, but that's, I guess, my kind of inspiration. And also, like, you know, I watched a lot of TV, and I like the show Sherlock. It's a good show, but I still remember I was like, why do they have to protest that they're not gay every episode? One, I mean, it's fine if you are. And, like, I actually... Like, John, you can be honest. But, like, also, you
at
know...
At this point.
What, yeah, like, dude, I don't care that you're married. That means nothing. But, like, you know, just why... Yeah, let people be friends with each other. And I'll have other characters in later books, you know, because I realized I was like, well, what about male and female friendships? That's also, like, a thing that people just blatantly ignore.
We're supposed to really stick to speculative fiction in this, but you did mention Sherlock, and I wonder whether you've watched Elementary?
A bit of it, yeah, which I'll be honest, I loved the acting, I loved the dynamic. I can't stand the procedural format.
That's fair enough. I'm sorry,
all of television, it's not your fault, can't do it.
No, that's fair enough. I really, really like it, because of the way that the relationship between Sherlock and Watson,
yeah, no, that was a good one. Like,
it is very good, and I thought, God, the reason they turned her into a woman is so that they can have them paired, but they're not paired at all.
Actually,
they've just got this really good friendship,
yeah,
which is very natural.
Yeah, no, it is, and there's this scene for male and female friendships. Not to jump back to Harry Potter, but like, that's my generation. Is as much as I'm not a super fond of the movies, there's one scene in like the second last one where it's just Harry and Hermione in the tent. And then, like, they put on music and they're dancing. And I was just like, yeah, this is people being friends. Why did we never see that? Like, I am sure I've mentioned at some point in one of the four books I've written and one that I've published now, Joshua does teach Peter to dance. Like, he doesn't know, and then he knows. That's, you know, it's all good.
He didn't learn it by osmosis.
No, he really didn't. I think it's an important... Just not just part of fiction, but part of real life is people being friends and people trying to find each other, because that's all we're really trying to do is, you know, be like, hey, you exist, I exist too. We did it.
Wow. What's going on here?
I know, it's shocking. Yeah, no, that was kind of my prerogative. I also wanted to do something with telepathy, because that's being able to read minds has been such a fundamentally horrifying idea to me since I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. Not just because, oh, it's loud all the time, but I remember in the second X-Men movie, Charles Xavier, Professor X, he freezes a room full of people, and then he's like, forget what you just saw, and wipes all their memories. And I remember I was like 6 years old, and I was like, that is the most fundamentally invasive thing I have ever seen.
I know, and he's meant to be the good guy.
Yeah, like, that's terrible. And I was like, well, what if people really were, like, you know, you ever play, like, chess against a computer, and when it makes a wrong move, you just press the backspace, and then you keep going. Like, what if people were just programmable to you? And I thought, well, that would be really dehumanizing. So I thought, what's the other most dehumanizing thing I can think of? And I actually thought living forever, because then people, I think, would stop being real. So
yeah.
As a way of kind of sadly isolating my characters, that's what I did to them. They can live forever, and people are open books to them.
Okay, so one more question before we sort of get on with the topic.
Yes.
Well, it's to do with the topic. What was, and this is going to be a hard one, what has one of your favorite speculative fiction friendships been?
Oh.
You don't need to say the absolute favorite. What's one that sort of sticks in your mind, or a few that stick in your mind that you really liked?
Oh my
just
god.
Just silence for the rest
that
of the
episode.
That's
such a terrible thing to ask me.
You're welcome.
Anyone who's ever met me before won't find this shocking at all. Franklin Nelson and Matt Murdock.
Yes!
Is just, I just love them so much. Sometimes I'm like, hey, that's not a friendship. It's okay, you two can kiss. But most of the time, no, they're a great example for me. But there are others. There's, oh my god.
Pale second place. Nelson and Murdock
so
take pride of place.
Oi, hey. Yeah, no, but I think a lot of them actually come from comic books, because I read a lot of comic books growing up, and that was a big part of it. But oh my god, that's all I can think about now. That's probably my favorite.
I do actually think that comic books treat friendships differently to the kind of things that you see in shows and in movies.
Well, I think because some comic writers have done terrible things. I'm not going to name any names. I'm just going to think them really loud in terms
maybe
of dynamics between men and men and women. And
yeah.
If you want to know more about that, everyone just follow me on Twitter, and in an hour or so, I'll go off. but yeah, no, I think there's given an opportunity there because, you know, in a comic, you know, it's never going to end. Like, no one will ever die or be canceled. It's fine. So you can afford that. And that's one of the reasons why I made my books a series, is because I was like, I'm more character-driven, but I also want a legitimate plot. So the more, like, if I make this huge thing, then I can afford to have whole chapters of people just talking to each other, which is my favorite part of the book, if I'm being honest, is people sitting on their front porch and just kind of, you know, hacking it out.
I think that's the thing, though, isn't it? Because you get more out of a character if you've got them interacting with another character. If you've just got a character by themselves, it's very difficult to let somebody in and see them unless you're using a first-person point of view, and even then it doesn't necessarily work.
I can't write in a first-person point of view. I can't do it, because then it just becomes me talking to whoever I imagine is reading, and there's no story, and it's just me going off.
It becomes your Twitter account.
Oh, my God. Yeah, no, and I'm also, like, I'm very kind of against splitting characters up. That's another thing that I wanted to do, is usually when there's two protagonists in a show or movie, at some point, they split up. And then I'm just like, and have their own, like, separate plots and problems. And I'm like, why? I thought you were best friends and you both have superpowers. Just, you know, stick together. That seems sensible.
Stop that now.
That does lead us on to an interesting aspect, and that's where you have two friends who are basically equally powered, if you like, in whatever way, and they're almost jockeying for the same spot at the top without realizing they're doing it. So you have, go back to the X-Men, you have Magneto and Professor X, who initially start off being
that's my other
friends.
Favorite friendship.
I know. There you go. Got it for you.
Oh, man.
And the thing is, because they have so much in common, but at the same time, how they go about getting to where they both think everyone should be, as in with all the mutants being accepted, is so fundamentally different. It's so diametrically opposed that they end up becoming enemies. And yeah. It's like a friendship gone sour. It's like the worst kind of enemy you could possibly have.
I think the worst anyone can ever write Professor X and Magneto is to have them genuinely be enemies trying to hurt each other. I do really think the proper way to write that relationship is two people having a fundamental disagreement about how the world works and how to go about fixing it. And I think their argument is fascinating. And because occasionally, and I hate saying it, but like once in a while, I look up and I'm you know, I haven't had enough coffee and it's dark outside and I'm like, Magneto was right. And you know, that's what I think makes him one of the best villains of all time. It's like you do, you know, when Darth Vader's like, come to the dark side, you're kind of like, no, you're definitely the bad guy. But occasionally Magneto makes a point and you're like, well, he's not totally wrong. And, you know, but yeah, no, they're an excellent friendship and relationship. And,
well,
and,
yeah, I think friendship, calling those two a friendship, I guess, again, it depends which angle you come at it from. But
I actually would call them a friendship. I, you know.
I tend to actually think that they're in love with each other.
Oh, well, yeah, no, they absolutely are. That's way more accurate.
I think that there is some romantic feeling there, but then again, it's non-actionable, if that makes sense. They never really act on it.
They could one day.
They could one day, which would be quite nice. I suppose it doesn't help the fact that obviously X-Men, the way I was introduced to X-Men really was the movies. They're the ones that, I mean, I watched the cartoon when I was little, but I really got introduced to X-Men from watching the movies. And of course you had Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart,
which is my favorite non-fictional
friendship. They've got the most epic partnership between them. They're brilliant, and so I do think of them as kind of in love. But that's an interesting trend that we do see in a lot of superhero comics and movies, is that you tend to have the hero and the villain are actually really good friends, especially when they don't know that the other is the other. They live the day to day as good friends, and then they're fighting. It's a common trend.
It's Harry Osborn and tropes.
That's fair enough. But you've got Harry Osborn and Peter Parker.
That's true. Yeah, you do. Mr. Fantastic and Doctor Doom.
Yeah.
By the way, for people who've just seen the movies, don't judge. I am writing my article on that is coming out like in a week. I have lots of feelings about Doctor Doom. It's not even the supervillain name. He's just Von Doom and he has a doctorate. Yeah, no, you're right. There's a trend of that in comics of people, you know, and I think that's true of real life, of people who are friends but fundamentally disagree. And I think in some ways that's a fascinating dynamic. It's not really the one that I have been capable of playing with, because I actually wanted to do the opposite of just, there's no problem here. But no, it's especially in that kind of heightened reality, I think it works really well.
But I think that often what they do is that enemies and heroes and stuff like that tend to actually be very alike. There's one fundamental difference that separates them. Now, in the case of Magneto and Eric and Charles, who I saw last Sunday for tea, Magneto and Xavier. Professor X is that fundamentally they're very similar. They're both highly intelligent men. They're both deeply caring about the mutant population, and they both want a better world. And how they disagree is that Xavier believes that we can live with humans, and kind of actually manipulates them. It's, as you pointed out, he manipulates people, and he does often. And like, that's actually, he could very easily be the bad guy. Whereas
he sometimes is, actually, in you know, the comics. Yeah. Occasionally the X-Men are like, Professor, we don't want you here anymore. And then they'll forget about it, and he can walk again, and he's dead again, and then
It's a cycle.
It's a cycle.
Whereas Eric, at least, is kind of a little bit more open about it. You know, he comes out, and they're like, I'm here to kill you all. We go, well, thank you for your honesty.
Yeah, well, you could argue that Magneto is honest about what he's doing, or you could say that he's just more dedicated to his rhetoric, because he's an extremist, and, you know, he might not always admit that sometimes what he's doing is from just a place of anger or trying to fill something in him that he doesn't quite understand. And I actually think that adds dimension to the characters. you know, how dedicated he is to his ideal, but at the same time, a part of it is probably not as altruistic as he believes it is.
Yeah.
Oh, another example is not quite Friends, but The Punisher and Daredevil, just to bring things back to Daredevil, if anyone watched the show recently, but also, you know, in the comics, that's another example where all the better place, but...
The Punisher's sort of a dark mirror to Daredevil. It would be so easy for Daredevil to actually step over that line.
That's actually a line in the book, you're one bad day from being me.
Yeah.
In the book, in this series.
Actually, that whole rooftop scene is from a, you know, where for anyone who hasn't watched the show yet, the entire third episode has Daredevil chained to a roof while the Punisher tries to convince him to shoot someone and they talk it out. That is almost word for word, but from a comic book by a man named Garth Ennis. Called Punisher the Choice, and it's an excellent, excellent book. No one understands the Punisher like that guy. Go read it, guys. Daredevil comes off a little bit worse in the comic than in the show, because that's a Punisher comic and it's a Daredevil show, but...
It's a very Daredevil, and I do want to talk about Daredevil, because I do want to talk about Nelson and Murdoch, because one of the subjects that we wanted to look at was male-male relationships.
Yeah.
Daredevil's very interesting, and the Punisher, the way they did that was really, really nice, because again, they're quite similar. And Daredevil actually he cares about Frank. You can tell he cares about Frank.
He understands.
But I think there's just this one bit I really like. Again, for anybody who hasn't seen the series yet, this is a bit of a spoiler, but it's on the boat, and Daredevil's just stopped him shooting the other guy. And the way the Frank reacts, it's like... He's been sort of inconvenienced by someone he knows. He's like, you asshole, you couldn't have given me that. Why did you do this?
I know. He goes like, come on, man, you couldn't just let me have this.
Yeah.
That's what he says.
Yeah, I know. That they're really sort of, but he's like, oh, come on, Red. And he's just like, ugh. Yeah.
That's also a really great scene, just in that, and this reflects on a lot of other of these relationships that we've talked about, is, you know, afterwards when Daredevil says, maybe we should go and kill the guy, and Frank, you know, and the Punisher says, no, you can't do that, because then you'd be me. And that, I think, is an interesting thing, and it's something that Magneto occasionally recognizes and on, is that they recognize almost there needs to be this other side, or like, that this person that they care about has to continue to be this way, or they won't be them anymore.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's so fascinating.
I agree, and I think that basically Daredevil, Frank, not Daredevil, Frank realized that, yeah, if Murdoch went down that path, it would destroy him, ultimately. It would destroy him, because he's not quite... Frank at this point has realized that there's something a little bit wrong with his brain.
He knows that, yeah. No, I think one of his best lines is, you know, he says, maybe I need a war. Like, he can't end for him.
Yeah, and he realizes that, but he knows that Daredevil cannot function in the same way. And it's as you say as well, Eric occasionally will stop Charles doing something because he knows that it would ultimately destroy Charles. And even though he disagrees with him and he wants Charles on his side, he doesn't want to hurt Charles. He knows that, which is why they can't really be friends, but they're definitely still friends.
Oh, totally. Yeah, no, and that's, I think, you know, it's a fascinating, it is always interesting, and not just in friendships where people fundamentally disagree in fiction, but just where one person says, I can do this, but you can't. And it's something I'd like to play with a little bit, because, you know, I have one character who has definitely murdered people and one who has not. of, you know, there are lines that, like, I will cross, but I won't let you do it, because...
Once you
cross. And I think, yeah, and I think that's a part of friendship, in a way, is almost idealizing someone. And maybe that's, I think, one of the less healthy things about friendship, is creating an idea of someone else in your head that maybe is not the most accurate thing. It might, you know, be a little bit more fictional than the real person, but I think that is definitely a thing, and letting that kind of idealization, like, drive you to be like, no, I need to, like, keep you this way. I think that plays into a lot of the friendships that we're talking about, is because these people have an idea of the other person.
Yeah.
And I don't think you have an idea of someone unless you really care about them.
I agree.
Just going to loop it back around to obviously what I said about Peter and Joshua making each other better.
Yeah.
As people, or better as characters, because of the way their relationship works. And you could argue the same thing for Magneto and Professor X, really.
Absolutely.
Because would either of them be as polar good, or as polar, you know, theoretically bad, if they didn't have an opposite number? Would there be a driving force?
I don't know, actually. That's an interesting question for those two.
Because, I mean, obviously, Magneto and Professor X, it was, you know, to explain the civil rights movement to white people in the 60s. Like, yeah. Magneto is an exaggerated Malcolm X, and Charles Xavier is an exaggerated Martin Luther King, and they're both white. But like that, you know, it was to try and explain yeah. that.
Yeah. Heaven forbid we actually have a black character represent, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the X-Men have become a more diverse I've got my qualms there. But like
yeah,
that,
that's not today's topic.
No. But it should be one. There's an argument that I think Charles is more driven because of Magneto.
Yeah.
I don't
yeah.
think the same is true in the reverse. I think Eric would be just the way he was if Charles wasn't around.
No,
maybe I think maybe he'd be worse.
I yeah. think Charles actually does tap into Magneto's humanity, the bits that are still there, the bits that didn't get buried under everything in the Nazi concentration camp in Poland. Yeah. So in some respects, yes, they do make each other better, but not in the same way.
Yeah. That's also, by the way, an interesting context of what if Charles had been, like, in the camps, you know? He grew up in the lap of, like, luxury, and he was okay.
Yeah.
Magneto didn't. So if you swapped them, I don't know.
Yeah, would they? Now, going back to Daredevil, there is another yeah. friendship in Daredevil that I would like to talk about, and I'd like to talk about in general, which is the friendship between Karen Page and Foggy Nelson.
Yeah.
Now, for those who watch the first series, Foggy has a bit of a crush on Karen in the first series, and they sort of try something out, but it doesn't really work out. And in
the building
end,
explodes, and they, you know.
Yeah, it's and Foggy just goes, this wasn't a very good first date.
No.
But ultimately, there's no awkwardness between that. They just both, it's not like they even really have a conversation saying this isn't working. They just sort of go, okay, and it kind of disintegrates. But they remain very, very good friends, which I think is something that is quite rare. We
yeah.
very rarely get good male-female friendships in fiction, and particularly in speculative fiction, especially in YA, because it's so often chosen one with love triangle
yeah.
and yeah different episode mm-hmm. you know
yeah.
what I mean
yeah.
it becomes a love thing
yeah it, which was really refreshing to see that yes, men and women can be friends. Surprise everyone. Oh, you know what another one is? Who's seen the movie Leon the Professional?
Okay. No.
go see the movie Leon the Professional. It's ridiculous, with like 12-year-old Natalie Portman and a French man who murders people, and they are good friends. It's great. That's an example of, you know, but like people can be friends. That's a thing. Like it really is. And it was really nice to see in Daredevil that they didn't go the love triangle route, because Karen Page is a character who in the comics was so repeatedly manipulated and abused and used by, like, in the story and by the writers just for whatever sense of drama they thought they could soak up. And it was just, you know, it was really nice to see them not do that. Just
mm-hmm.
not, but like, yeah, no, it's, I
no,
really
she,
enjoyed
she,
their friendship.
She does have a good, friendship. And that trio, because so often the moment you have the dynamic of one woman, two men,
yeah,
it usually dissolves. And whilst I do quite enjoy the fact that, you know, Karen and Matt started sort of kissing and stuff, they do get together
so
a little bit.
I'm also actually kind of glad that they stopped.
Yeah, me too. That really, really bugged me.
Yeah.
You know, they were in the second one. It bugged Foggy as well, but I don't think it was because he was jealous. I think it was he was just there like, guys. Got the most
well, but was he jealous? Like,
life.
If he was jealous, he wasn't jealous of Matt. Let's just be clear.
Yeah.
He was jealous of Karen.
they need to
I'm undercutting
resolve these feelings.
Yeah, they should hash it out. No, but like, yeah, there's. I wasn't so fun, you know, because they're like love interests in the comics. That's fine, but I was kind of like, nah, the Karen Page you've put into this show isn't the Karen Page of the comic books, you know. She's like a full character with her own agency and reporting skills, I guess, which I really, really loved.
Yeah.
That was one thing that did bother me a little bit, was the fact that, you know, she was really obviously good as a reporter and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, she was good at the investigation stuff. And then he said, now write this thing. And I'm like, you have no idea. She could be a terrible writer.
I did.
Just
I didn't care.
I was like, you're just assuming that she knows how to write.
She's a woman. She's
so
managed
thrilled.
To find all the stuff out. She must be an excellent writer. And I'm like, how do you know?
He said, you go and write it. And I was like, so we're not going the route where she becomes a heroin addict in LA in the comics. I am good with it. Karen, you just have magical writing skills. Because that's what happens to her in the comics. And spoiler alert to, you know, people who don't read. Eventually in the comics, she dies. And it's really brutal fridging. And I'm still mad at Kevin Smith. Oop, I said I wouldn't name anyone. I did. Come at me. But no, I was really, like, it did bug me as I was like, she doesn't know how to write an article. You like, that's not even, like, natural talent. You were just like, what margins is she supposed to be using? Is there, like, a font? Or is, like, is this Chicago? Like, what does she do? But no, it's fine.
How does she reference?
Yeah, like, what is, do you want in-page citations? Or, Ellison, come back.
It wasn't just that. It's that, you know, someone can be really, you know, we've got detectives and stuff like that. But that doesn't mean that you know how to write an engaging piece of... So my partner and I were laughing about it the whole way through. We were like, you know, that this boss, just they're like, yeah, you write it, it'll be great and stuff like that. And then he gets it and he's there like, oh, God.
You're
someone
fired.
Else is going to really have to... Wow, okay, you just stick that. To the investigatory part. Leave the writing to everybody else. Like, seriously. Aww. But no, I was pleased, by the way, that they weren't
really
that out.
I was really thrilled, actually. Especially because I was really upset by Ben Urich dying in the first season. Oh, man, I'm giving just so many... Maybe put, like, a spoiler disclaimer.
It's fine.
We will.
Sorry, people at this point know.
No, I love him in the comic. He's my favorite. He's the best. Yeah, no, but that friendship was really good. And that's why I was almost kind of glad that Karen and Matt didn't stay together long. Because I was kind of like, no, I liked the dynamic of just three, like, really stupid people sitting in this small office. Because they really are not very smart in a lot of ways.
Like, they're smart in some ways and they're really
dumb.
Yeah,
but like others. I did kind of appreciate that the thing that Matt and Karen really seemed to have in common was just they're both like, danger? Yes. Like, that seemed to be their unifying factor.
I just like the fact, I also like the friendship, the growing friendship between this police officer and Karen. Because every time he shows up to a scene, he's there like, you, really? You're here again?
Brett? I actually hate Brett. He was my least favorite character because he was just an exposition machine. I'm
this
sorry, Brett. Sorry, Brett.
I felt he had more in this.
Yeah, he did,
in the later series.
Still not my favorite. Like, everything he said, I was like, ah, they needed someone to say something for the trailer, huh? I'm trying to think of other great friendship. Oh, I'm not just thinking of this because I'm hearing British accents, but from Doctor Who, I'm sorry. I would say that show has its ups and downs, but, like, the best...
It,
sorry,
it does.
Doctor
it depends
Who.
Who's writing, I think.
It really does. But, like, I would say of the, like, 11 years that it's been on since it came back is the best dynamic was between David Tennant and Catherine Tate.
Yes.
Of Donna Noble, because they were just best friends. Everyone else, there was, like, doughy eyes being made. But, like, what was the actual best dynamic? The one where they're just really happy to be running around together. You know, that's something worth taking
regardless
away from.
Regardless of what you thought of her character, it was nice that for once the doctor's companion wasn't in love with him.
Yeah,
They were just friends, and that was actually very nice. Regardless of what you thought of her as a character, that was a nice dynamic.
It's not just the character,
Donna,
I can't stand
okay.
the actress either. So that entire thing just really bothered me, but that's personal. So
I liked Donna more as she went along. I think whenever Russell T. Davies wasn't writing her, she was more of a character. No offense, sir, you're an excellent man. But yeah, no, that's just another
he's
example.
Not listening.
That's
if
probably
he is,
true.
We're
hello.
We're doing
if he is,
very
then,
well.
You know, does he fancy like slinging a tweet our way?
Yeah. Would you like to come onto the show?
But I think that's a really great example because that's a dynamic where like they did romantic 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times, and the one that everyone was like, we really like this one, is the one where they were just friends, which I think really drives home my point of without meaning to or knowing it, we like seeing that. We like seeing people being friends. There's something fun about it. There's something like just inherently just more, almost more interesting about two people being friends than two people being like, oh, do I ever tell them? Like,
yeah.
So moving on to what I feel is even the most rarest friendship that you see of all is the friendship between two women in speculative fiction. Now, the reason this is rare is that usually it's male-dominated. A lot of speculative fiction is male-dominated, so you have a few female characters, but they don't really interact that much. Or if they do, they're kind of pit against each other.
Which is just depressing as hell.
Which is very depressing. Because God forbid women actually are friends without, you know, being related.
I know, right? No, it's... I think I mentioned it... Did I ever mention Firefly yet? I don't remember.
No, not yet. Let's talk about Firefly.
Yeah, let's talk about Firefly. That's a great... That's an example I always jump to of, like, you know, of a fairly even cast, and there are, you know, men and women, and women and women, and men and men, and also whatever Jane is, are... Jane's a girl's name, I'm just saying. They're like friends with each other. Everyone's friends with Kaylee. It's great. You know, it's a weird, and I think there's, but who was allowed to write speculative fiction? Like, who would send in a submission somewhere and get accepted? You know, because I hear the argument once in a while of, oh, women didn't write a lot of speculative fiction. I'm like, that's probably not true. It's more likely that men were getting accepted for, you know, by publishers and magazines and stuff like, and, you know, I'm a man, I'm reading Stranger in a Strange Land right now by Robert A. Heinlein, and yeah. Oh my god, I just...
Well, it's good to remember that, yeah. That sci-fi was created as a genre, the first real example of sci-fi that we have.
Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yes, exactly. And actually, yes. I'm pretty sure that the superhero trope came from the Scarlet Pimpernel.
I think it did, yeah.
That's the origin of that, which was a female. Yeah. So the idea that it's like, oh, women are only just getting into it, like, no, we invented it, thank you.
You know what? Props to Mary Shelley. I love the story of Frankenstein. Mary Shelley and Lord Byron were, like, locked in a house in a thunderstorm, and they were like, I dare you to do something new. And they went, okay. And he invented the modern vampire, and she created science fiction.
Yep.
I'm like, wow, that was a good dare. God.
Minor correction there. It's actually Polidori who wrote the vampire. Polidori was Byron's neurotic doctor. But he used Byron's name as as to sell the book for years and years and years afterwards.
My God.
So he sort of wrote, and of course Byron couldn't defend against it because he'd been exiled from Britain because of his gambling debts and the affair he had with his sister.
Okay, I'll correct the
answer. Excuse me, Lord Byron.
Byron dared Mary Shelley to write something new, and she invented science fiction. God bless that dare.
Yeah. Apparently all good things happen in Geneva, so there you go.
Oh, okay.
If you ever really need to write something, go with a couple of creepy people, lock yourselves in a house in Geneva, and you'll create a new genre.
I hope. There are a couple other ways that could end. I think a part of the problem was who's being allowed to write science fiction, and some of the people who are being allowed have no interest in writing fully fleshed out female characters.
Yep. It was a generational thing as well, the way that women were understood, their roles and things like that, and their relationships, it was reflected in the way that they were written. But even now, and I think that because all these new generations of writers, you know, who have more opportunities now, female writers, a lot more opportunity to get their stuff out there. They were raised on stuff which was written without women, and therefore subconsciously we tend to prefer to write about men, actually, you kind of have to burst our own bubbles and go, hang on, what's so wrong about writing about women? So even female writers will fall into this trope because they don't see female characters as interesting, even if they themselves are women.
Yeah, and I think full disclaimer as we continue to talk about this, people should know I'm not, like, being a hypocrite, but it's worth saying that I wrote my first book as a 15-year-old boy. It is two men and one woman as the dynamic in my very first book. Like, I fell into that trap because
I think there was a lack of self-awareness. But you're right, because that's what we're exposed to.
I don't think people should be blamed for that. I wrote The Sons of Thirsty and I was 17. And it was, the main three characters. It's two guys and a girl. And it's just, and the two main characters are guys. And even now, even though I've evened out the playing field in sort of later books, because I suddenly became conscious of the fact, I suddenly thought, why do I hate women so much? This is really odd. I even now, it's still male-centric. And I think that that's just something that we need to get over. But going back to friendships, let's concentrate not on what isn't, but what is.
Okay.
So can we think of some really good examples of some female friendships in speculative fiction?
Kira and Dax in Deep Space Nine.
That was a very quick response.
Yeah, you had that prepared. While we were going off on a tangent, you were like, I'm ready.
You know, I'm really interested listening to you guys, but I'm trying to get word in.
Sorry.
So sorry, Jules.
So sorry.
It's okay. I was thinking one of my favourite friendships is probably Bashir and O'Brien from Deep Space Nine. And I thought, well, actually, Kira and Dax have a really good friendship there. They're not against each other. They probably do make each other a bit better as people. It's not as close and it's not as focused on, but I think it is a reasonably good example. But it is very difficult to find female-female friendships.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it now. I'm trying.
Well, yeah. One that I really like is that, I don't know if you go, and for friendships in general, is the Avatar series. So Avatar The Last Airbender.
Yeah!
And Avatar The Legend of Korra. And the way they do friendships there, I think is really accurate, because they've got these friendship groups. And within these friendship groups, there are romances, which don't all work out, which I think does happen in real life, is that if you hang around with a group of people, eventually two of them do start dating, then they stop dating, and then other people date, and, you know, but the most important, people do that all the time. That's a very natural thing. Because if you spend your time, you know, if you're young, you're spending your time with a lot of other people, you go, oh, I guess we should be boyfriend and girlfriend now. So there are some great friendships in that series between female characters. So you've got Toph and Katara.
Even they started off as the kind of pitched against each other, though.
Yeah, but they weren't pitched against each other because of women, because they were women. They were pitched against each other because of their characters, which is what happens. Because usually what happens is that when two male characters don't get along, it's because of their characters. But when two female characters don't get along, it's because they're both women and they're vying for the attention of a person or etc. Okay.
Yeah, there can be only one.
Yeah. I am the only one. I am the supreme. Whereas in this case, they're vastly different people. And they were struggling to kind of to work together, because you've got Katara, who's a little bit of a neat freak, who's a little bit sort of obsessive compulsive, I guess, in some. Okay, I shouldn't really use that, because she's not obsessive compulsive, but she, you know, she's very,
very
straight.
Organized.
Yeah, she's very organized. She sees things in a very linear way usually, and she's quite a composed person until she loses her temper. Whereas Toph is very brusque. Toph knows what she wants pretty much at all points. She's not necessarily a very compassionate person, and yeah, so they bashed heads until they didn't, and they started getting along.
Right,
and that's a fantastic friendship.
Oh,
then yeah.
No, you keep going, but I thought of one.
That's a good thought, then.
Sorry, it takes me a minute.
And then we go to The Legend of Korra. And again, this one isn't quite the same, because you've got Asami and Korra. Now they start off, they are friends, but they are kind of both vying for Mako. And initially Asami is dating Mako, then he breaks up with her to be with Korra. But the way I like that it ends is that they just become friends anyway, and then they end up together at the end. Asami and Korra both go off together on a romantic holiday into the spirit world, holding hands.
Yeah.
Which is really nice, and so that was a nice, because I thought, oh great, it's going to be the love triangle between the two girls, and then they totally flipped it on its head, and I thought, I can work with this.
I actually watched alarmingly little of The Legend of Korra, but I did end up being shown that last episode, and I was like, yeah, I like it, giant robots and spirit journeys. One I thought of, and this might be a little bit less well known because, you know, it's not represented in any of the movies because these characters aren't all there, but Captain Marvel and Spider-Woman in comic books of Jessica Drew and Carol Danvers are best friends, and people don't talk about that enough, but it's really great, and they hang out and show up in each other's books, and they're just happy to be around each other and punching people. I've always really enjoyed that one. There's also like a fair few of the X-Men, I would say, just Kitty Pryde and just whoever's around her, if they're not Emma Frost. She seems pretty happy to be around people. I like that one.
Yeah.
That's one that I, because again, you know, everything I come at is from comic books.
But it is interesting that actually the best friendships, again, that this whole topic has been dominated by comic books, and not just because of your interest in comic books, but because I think that comic books do really write friendships beautifully.
Yeah. Well, because again, I think there's, you know, a reason that I think there's always like people ending up together and it's a romance and that's the end is part of the problem is, I think when you're writing just one story, is you're looking for a sense of closure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that for a lot of people, that's what they think, that's how they think an ending is supposed to go. And
yeah.
Comic, you're like, no, this is never going to end. People die and their stories don't end in these books, so it's fine.
And I think also with comics, because there's the visual element as well, that aids in the fact that you're able to have more characters because people are able to sort of see them more, because it's difficult to remember lots of different names if you're reading something.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah.
But if you've got this ongoing series and you can see differences and you've got different names, and because comic books tend to follow superheroes who tend to have a group dynamic, it means there's more chance for these friendships. There's more opportunity.
And there is absolutely something said for not being able to follow that many characters, because, you know, if you look at my book, you realize how many real characters are there? 3. How many are fully fleshed out? 2. you know, I don't juggle that many different personalities well. But yeah, no, that's true, is a visual element adds something in a way that a movie can't do, because in a movie, too many people, you're just fighting for screen time.
Yeah.
It just doesn't, you know. Poor Hawkeye.
Okay, I'm going to steer this in a... Yeah, poor Hawkeye. Not that we don't like having him there in nice action poses, some of us. But moving on from that, friendships where they've gone really above and beyond. I'm thinking sort of, you know, I'd walk into Mordor with you kind of friendships.
That is the ultimate friendship. Not just so I'd just walk Sam into Mordor. Frodo.
That's kind of like, without hesitation, I would step onto a bullet for you kind of thing. And, you know, I'd be smiling when I did it.
Yeah. But it is the ultimate friendship, because it's not just I would walk into Mordor for you, it's I would carry you up the last bit of the way.
Yeah, you lazy ass. Like,
I think there were more things going on there than laziness, to be honest. I don't think it was just Frodo like, meh.
But I like that version much better. Frodo's like, ah, I trust you.
They'll be fine.
Yeah.
I agree. That's... And where, interestingly enough, we see a lot of that dynamic that I'd take a bullet for you is often in stories which are centered around war. And I think it's because it's something that we see in soldiers. It's war and sort of police, and it's high action.
Yeah.
Because that is a real mentality.
Mm. Because it's all about, you know, what kind of reality is this dynamic existing within? Like in just like, if it was just two people hanging out, then the possibility that one of them could take a bullet for the other is kind of low. But if it's in the middle of a war zone, then it's like, yeah, no, we can actually act that out. It's good. Like that's totally true.
But it's also fostered. This relationships are fostered under that kind of duress, which you don't get in the day-to-day.
Yeah.
You simply don't. And because being with somebody in that point, sharing laughter and things like that, it's ultimately more precious because everything else around you is hell.
Yeah.
So the idea of sacrificing yourself for that isn't quite as alien as if you were just, you know, in the day-to-day, just walking around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's true, I think, in situations of, you know, trauma and high duress and stress and insanity. It makes people are like I said, you know, what's a friendship other than someone going, I'm here, you're here, let's be here together. Like, that's the... you know.
With regards, it is interesting now that Frodo and Sam are so often paired now. People are like, oh, it was very gay at the end. And I'm like, well, maybe it was. Maybe that's what they were filming for. But it's the fact that people can't seem to understand. You don't see guys hugging a lot.
No.
In film. And actually, I've met a few guys in my time, and they hug an awful lot.
there are huggers out there. By the way, if we're going to pair anyone in Lord of the Rings, it's not Frodo and Sam, it's Legolas and Gimli.
Yeah.
Oh, like, easy. That's a great friendship.
No, not as friend. Like, Frodo and Sam are the friendship. Legolas and Gimli are the romance.
There are quite a lot of things in there which made me think, Tolkien, are you for real? Like, Legolas built Gimli a ship so that they could go off to the place,
I know.
The nice place and stuff. Anyway.
Oh my god. Anyway.
not the point. The point is that there are, you know, I've met a few guys in my time, you know, in my few years, they sometimes appear. And they do hug. There are guys out there who hug. And actually, there are guys out there who hug when their friends are upset.
Yeah.
And it does happen.
I know. Well, yeah. I think there's an element of toxic masculinity in never showing that in media. You know, this like, hey, that's not what Schwarzenegger and the other guy did in Predator. They must be gay. And I'm like, it's fine if they are. We need more of that, too, in fiction. But like, yeah, guys can hug.
Guys can definitely hug. And again, this is going back to Matt Murdock and Foggy Nelson. Sorry, Jules. it goes back to that really lovely moment in the first series where Foggy's found out that Matt is Daredevil, and he and they have this argument, and Matt starts crying because he thinks he's going to lose Foggy.
He's crying like big ugly tears, and you know what? So is Foggy a bit.
Yep, they are both like bawling. You know, they really clearly need to hug it out, and they're incredibly close.
I would say the only reason they don't hug in that scene is because Matt's still mostly covered in his own blood.
Yeah. Also, Matt is bleeding internally and all sorts of other stuff.
Yeah, he shouldn't
probably
move.
Needs to be addressed. So yeah, maybe like, that's a shouldn't thing. Be like, squeezed.
Yeah, like, but these people like crying. You know, that was a big thing for me. I was like, yeah, we don't see enough of that.
Yeah, especially because they managed to maintain that they managed to show. Yeah. Matt is a really masculine guy. He really is a masculine guy.
With his satin sheets. And...
Yeah. he's got all... No, but he does have all the traditionally... You know, the faults that he has are the traditionally masculine. So he's a little bit arrogant. He's got a temper. You know, he does have all of those traditional kind of qualities. And yet, the only time you really see him cry in the series is when he thinks he's losing Foggy.
Yeah. And that's true in the books, too. You know, I can think of a couple times where he thinks Fog is gone, and he just falls apart. But not only that, there's one written by Ed Brubaker in the early 2000s where he thought Foggy was dead, and he comes back, and there's just a full splash page of them hugging. You know? Which was just, I know, it was great. It's a good, like, we have this weird thing in our media of not allowing men to show emotions, but also not allowing men to show emotions in regards to each other. I think there's a latent homophobia element to it as well.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a bit misplaced as well, though, because it's like two guys hugging does not equal, you know, two guys in bed. It's like, it wouldn't matter if it did, but it doesn't, so.
And yeah, we go back historically as well.
I do think that's a part of the problem.
I mean, historically as well, in England, up until the sort of the Victorian era, men walking around arm in arm was an incredibly common thing. Yeah. Holding hands, stuff like that. It was a thing that's friendship. And I've lived in the Middle East for a lot of my life. And seeing guys walking hand in hand and arm in arm, arms slung around the shoulders, in ways that if we saw it in the UK, we'd go, oh, they must be gay. They are obviously not gay in the Middle East, at least not openly, you know. But because in a lot of these countries where homosexuality is illegal, because that kind of behavior would never even be displayed, it wouldn't even be thought of, you know, apparently, behavior like that is equated with friendship and the love between brothers and friends, you know.
Yeah.
And it's all about perspective. It is about perspective. And in the you know, up until the Victorian era, people, guys and were hand in hand, and they stopped. They literally stopped for fear because homosexuality became a thing, because apparently it didn't exist before then. but you know, it became a concern, I guess.
Yeah.
They stopped doing it because they didn't want to be misunderstood, and that just hasn't stopped.
Yeah, I think it's probably worth at this point in the discussion, almost as a disclaimer, saying that we are not being against gay relationships being displayed and explored in fiction. I actually think we need more of it. This isn't, you know, really a thing specifically about gender, but so much as just talking about people being able to have like close platonic friendships between men and men and men and women and women and women and whatever else you might identify as. I just felt like that's important to say, is I'm not, you know, I don't think any of us are being like, no, they're just friends. That's not the point of this.
Sorry.
Okay, cool. Just wanted to say.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Ben on that. This is obviously not the topic of our episode this week. We will talk about it in another episode. But yeah, today we have been talking about friendships, and I actually think that we're going to have to...
We are going to have to sort of wrap it up, I think, because we've been talking for an hour.
Well, I'm sorry, Jules has mostly been cut off.
I am so sorry.
It's been fascinating, it really has. I don't feel I've contributed enough, but...
Very sorry, Jules.
But that's okay, we should get you two together and, you know, the fossil can sit in the corner.
Oh, don't say that!
You're young, you're good.
All right then, so just to review what we've looked at, we've mostly been looking at comics today, so we've looked at Daredevil quite prominently. If you haven't realised that at this point, you probably haven't been listening. We looked at Daredevil, we looked very briefly at X-Men.
Yep.
And Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. We touched on Sherlock Holmes, even though we probably shouldn't have. We touched also on the Avatar series, both The Legend of Korra and The Last Airbender. And finally, we obviously looked at Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
And obviously Witchman Road, since, got Ben.
Hi.
At this point, we very much recommend you go and check out Witchman Road. I've got it on my shelf, as I said, and Jules has read it and can stand by it.
It's so really good. Definitely go and read it.
Yeah. So thank you for coming on the show, Ben.
Well, thank you so much. And maybe I'll come back one day because I didn't go enough into my thoughts on Spock and Kirk.
We'll invite you, but we'll have an episode entirely about.
I think we're going to have an episode entirely about Daredevil because that seems to be another thing you need to get out of your system.
Oh, that's never coming out.
We need to have an episode entirely about Hawkeye as well.
Yeah, but like comic book. Oh, that was another male on female friendship in the comic books is Clint Barton and Kate Bishop as the two Hawkeyes. Okay, I said
yes. Good. We can wrap up. Yeah, except she's kind of a love. Okay, no, we're not going to talk about.
No. Pulling you back in again.
Sorry.
Okay. So thank you very much for listening, guys.
And thank you very much for coming on the show, Ben.
And thank you for having me.
You'll have to come back again, I think.
Totally.
That's all around.
Okay.
All right. We'll see you next week, then.
See you.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.